Please take your seats. We're going to get started. Today is the local. This is the meeting of the Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs Committee. Today is Wednesday, February 14th. We do not yet have a quorum, so I'll officially call it to order as soon as we get a quorum. But today is the hearing of the oversight of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. And I'd like to get started. Because it's Valentine's Day, I do have cookies and water and pop on the cart. And so as we get more members to show up, we'll pass them out, or you can help yourself to what's on the cart. That would be great. But with that, I think I'm going to ask Jeffrey, is it Hamill? Is that how I pronounce it? To please come to the table and bring whoever else you would like to the table to get started. Please state your name for the record and then go ahead.
Hello, Madam Chair. Can you hear me if I sit in the middle and talk loudly?
I can.
It's a crowded table today, and let me introduce a couple of folks. My name is Jeff Hamill. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. And with me today is Susan Warner Dooley, who is Deputy Executive Director for Finance and Administration, to address issues of our budget and our financing process. And Tom Anderson is our General Counsel, and Tom is here today to talk about our recent negotiation with the airlines regarding airport rates and charges. Another two issues that the committee expressed interest in hearing about when we had the tour of the airport about a week ago. By the way, Madam Chair, thank you very much for taking the time to come to the airport and to actually spend the hours that you did taking a drive around our facility, taking a look at the airport's facilities and the airport itself. It was extremely opportune for us to share that information with you, and we just appreciate you taking the time to do so. By way of just some brief remarks, I brought these two folks today because you heard plenty from me last week. And you've got some specific information you wanted to hear about today, so we'll get to that just momentarily. Let me just review for those members who are here today who were not on the bus tour, and I'll make this very, very brief and quite quick. A little bit about what the MAC is all about, what is the MAC, talk about our purpose, talk about our board makeup and composition, a little bit about our noise program, just a purely introductory remark, some of the basic statistics that relate to the Airports Commission. There's a noise contour included in some handouts that I believe you will have available, and economic impact of the airport, and then we'll move on with other specific issues you requested. First of all, by way of background, the Metropolitan Airports Commission was created by the Minnesota State Legislature in 1943. You created as the first commission in the metropolitan community, the Southern County metro area. It was created to oversee and manage the overall aviation service and needs of all types of users in the Twin Cities area in the state of Minnesota. Specifically, we had at that time North Central Airlines as a brand new, actually Wisconsin Central, then North Central Airlines in the metropolitan area, as well as Northwest Airways and Northwest Airlines in our community. And at that time in 43, the governor, who was Harold Stassen at the time, and the legislature felt that Minneapolis-St. Paul, Minnesota could in fact become a significant hub of future aviation growth in the community. And as a result, they created the Metropolitan Airports Commission and asked us to provide aviation services and facilities to all types of users. We do operate a regional transportation system. We have all the airports in the seven-county metropolitan area under our jurisdiction of some form or another. We actually directly operate seven airports in the metro area: Minneapolis-St. Paul International, St. Paul Downtown Airport, on the east side of the Twin Cities, the Lake Elmo Airport, to the north, the Anoka County Blaine Airport, the Crystal Airport, which is located adjacent to the city of Crystal and the other communities, to the west of the suburban areas of Eden Prairie, the Flying Cloud Airport, and south, the Air Lake Airport in Lakeville. So that's our airport system. MAC's purpose is to create and to promote air transportation and commerce within the seven-county metropolitan area, and you'll show you in a few moments what kind of economic impact the airport and its facilities actually do have on the community overall. Our mission statement is pretty clear. We do have one. We work hard on it. We provide and promote safe, convenient, environmentally sound, cost-competitive aviation services for our customers. By the way, our customers are defined as not just the traveling public in the state of Minnesota, but in fact, customers, the Airports Commission, include the airline companies that serve the service community, as well as all the businesses and activities that are associated and provide services to the traveling public, namely the food and beverage dealers in the terminal building, and the concessions to provide retail sales and so forth. All of those business activities We view as customers of the Metropolitan Airports Commission and partners in providing services to the community. The board composition has changed over the years, and the board has grown from its original 7 or 9 members to 15 members today. Of the 15 members, 13 of our board members are appointed by the governor of the state of Minnesota, and 2 of our seats are occupied by the mayor of Minneapolis and the mayor of St. Paul, representing their specific cities. If you take a look at the appointments, there are 8 districts. Let me pick it back a moment. The Metropolitan Council has 16 districts in the metro area. What the MAC did was combine every 2 of those Met Council districts into 1 airport district. And as a result, while they have 16 member district members of the council, there are in fact 8 commissioners representing the 7 of the 8, I'm sorry, the 8 districts from the metropolitan area for the Twin Cities area, the San Antonio metro area. On top of those 8 metro representatives, there are 4 out-of-state or greater Minnesota representatives for a total of 12. We have the mayor of Minneapolis, mayor of St. Paul for 14, and the chair of the commission, which he makes for 15. And they basically serve 4-year terms with the exception of the mayoral representatives and the chair. The chair serves at the pleasure of the governor, and the 2 mayors who are occupied by representatives who serve the term of the mayor. Otherwise, commissions have basically a 4-year term, and those are staggered terms, so that in fact we do have overlap, but we don't see a complete replacement of our board at any one time following an election.
Excuse me, I do have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell me if they are the other members that are not the mayor, and are they confirmed? They're appointed by the governor, but are they confirmed by the Senate, or is it just a straight-out appointment by the governor?
Yeah, there is not a confirmation by the Senate or the legislature. The governor makes those appointments. He's supposed to do it in consultation, I believe, with representatives of the community, but those are not confirmed here officially.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Airport operations-wise, let me ask, do you have this handout?
We didn't. I just got it.
Oh, you did. Okay. It's quite easy to read, and so it'll be a quick catch-up for you if you don't have it in front of you. MAC operations, many people are surprised to learn that the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport ranks 10th in the world in total aircraft operations. That is the 10th largest airport worldwide. Significant airport. Now, this number does fluctuate, so I'll caution. You can read numbers that go anywhere from 8th, 9th, 10th, to 12th, to 13th. So don't hold me to the 10th. It depends on each year's variation. For example, in 2007 and late 2006, with Northwest Airlines filing bankruptcy and the downsizing, that did change the numbers. It's probably bumped up to like the 12th of today. But it'll fluctuate within that range, either nationally or worldwide. That 10th rank accounts for about 500,000, slightly less than 500,000 takeoffs and landings every year. Our reliever airport system, so the other 6 smaller airports that are located on the metro area that I just described, they account for another 500,000 takeoffs and landings a year, and that's what we call them reliever airports. They provide landing surfaces for aircraft that don't require 8, 9, 10, 12,000 foot runway surfaces, but can operate off of smaller runways and still meet the community's needs.
Excuse me, Representative Dominguez.
Going back to the, thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the ranking, you said 10th or 12th right in that area. How many rankings are there?
Mr. Hamill.
Madam Chair, Representative Dominguez. There are numerous types of rankings or way of measuring airports, but there are 2 basic categories. One category is taken with the size of the airport based on how many aircraft take off and land out of that airport on an annual basis. That's what this ranking is based upon. Another rank that's very popular or common is the number of passengers who pass through the airport on an annual basis. And those are the 2 primary ways that they compare and evaluate airports both in the United States, in North America as a whole, and worldwide.
Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So where do we fit as far as, you know, from 100 to 10? How many, in what capacity?
In the United States.
Mr. Hamill.
Madam Chair. I represent Dominguez. In the United States, I would say that we probably rank about 8th or 9th in total operations, that is takeoffs and landings, and about 12th in total passenger activity. And again, those numbers do fluctuate. I don't know how we're doing in 2007, but year-end 2006, I haven't seen the official tally yet. That's not where we're going to end up. The bottom line is that Minneapolis-St. Paul, Minnesota, if you were to take a national map and put up on the wall and ask people, you know, what are the top 10 busiest airports in the country, people would look at New York, Kennedy, LaGuardia, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, maybe. I doubt that they would put Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport as one of the top 10 airports in any category, but the reality is that we are. This is a huge piece of the national transportation system. We have about 35 million passengers a year that pass through the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, and again, almost 500,000 takeoffs and landings, 475,000 operations last year. So it's a large enterprise and large operation. The next page is MSP statistics. Let me just point out a couple of characteristics that are important for you to notice. First of all, going back to 1996, which is when we began the airport expansion program, this $3+ billion airport expansion, we had about 485,000 takeoffs and landings. It grew to a high in 2000 of 523,000. And of course, we're all aware of the fact that two things happened starting in 2000. In 2000, we started to see a national decline in the economy, or a slowing of our economy following the dot-com era of 1995 to 2000. And that slowing economy started to cut back and slow down the passenger activity, and the numbers started to back off a bit. And of course, then in September of 2001, we saw a dramatic impact with the terrorist attacks in New York and in Washington. And as a result, we almost froze and stopped at 501,000. And we've been building since that time, once again, with the exception of 2006, where we saw another decline after some growth as a result of the Northwest Airlines bankruptcy in 2005.
If I could interrupt you for just one moment, we officially have a quorum, so we'll officially call the meeting to order.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the operations fluctuate based on a whole variety of external factors, and the message here, as we take a look at both operations and passengers, is that this is a highly volatile industry. We see a lot of fluctuation, and things like the national economy, terrorist events, airline bankruptcies, and so forth, all these kinds of influences affect how we rank. That's why I say be careful with the numbers, but about 8th to 10th in overall operational size, 12th, 13th in overall passenger activity makes for a very large airport. In the United States in 2003, there were 33 large hub airports defined by the FAA. A large hub airport is an airport that transports more than 1% of the total passenger activity of the nation in 1 year. I think that in 2006 there were actually 30 large hub airports, so that number fluctuates as well. I'm getting longer than I wanted to, Madam Chair, so let me just move along. Looking at noise mitigation, just to tell you briefly, you can read as well as I, that Minneapolis-St. Paul Metropolitan Airports Commission has, bar none, the most aggressive noise mitigation program in the country. And I will tell you that I know of no other airport authority in the world that has done more on a per capita basis to deal with noise impacts than Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. We've insulated almost 7,700 homes. All of the homes in the 65 DNL contour have now been completed. We've insulated 17 schools within 65 DNL contour. At the end of the day, with land acquisitions, home insulations, school acquisitions, multifamily property treatments, we spent $340 million, which is more on a per capita basis than any airport in the land. And, of course, there's a shot of the noise contour itself, a map on the next page. Let me just tell you that the red represents all of the homes that have already been insulated and noise mitigated and attenuated as part of our noise program since 1996. Next page is economic impact of the airport, Madam Chair and members. Economic impact analysis that was done for the Airports Commission a few years ago identified about 153,000 total jobs, not on the airport, total jobs in a metropolitan community of people who work directly for the airport, as well as folks who work for organizations who do business with the airport whose jobs tied back to the airport in some capacity or another. About $6 billion personal income contribution to people who work or receive income from some form of the airport. Overall impact of the airport, $10.7 billion in total business revenue. What that means, Madam Chair, to this body is that there is no other piece of real estate anywhere in the state of Minnesota that generates the amount of economic impact and contribution to the economy of the state and the region than does the 3,000 acres at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. $1.3 billion in local purchases and $626 million paid in state and local taxes. Tying up top-notch air service, the Twin Cities comprise the 15th largest metropolitan community in the nation, but it's the second in nonstop destinations per 100,000 residents. In other words, we have nothing short of phenomenal air service. People who live in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area, people who live in the state who come to this airport for air transportation services, can go nonstop or one-stop more frequently to more destinations than anybody else in the country except for one other city, and I believe that other city is New York. But we have a phenomenal level of air service here, serving, I think, some 135 cities nonstop out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. 98% of the travelers who have access to competitive air service nonstop are both one-stop service. Management, this is where I get to brag about the staff, and I won't go overboard. I'll simply tell you that I think I have the finest airport staff in the country. They are folks who have been doing this for a very long time. We have an infiltration of new talent with highly qualified people joining our staff as well. The bottom line is that Minneapolis-St. Paul is nationally recognized as one of the best-run operations in the country. We enjoy that reputation because, quite frankly, I believe that I've been fortunate to have a remarkably competent, intelligent, dedicated staff who, quite frankly, has committed their entire careers to working at improving Minneapolis-St. Paul. The awards on the next page, don't have to go through them. You can look at them as well. Second-best large airport in the Americas, third-best airport in the world for overall customer service, second-best world for domestic travel, concessions programs, snow plowing, safety awards. We're pleased with that recognition because it shows our recognition of an awful lot of hard work. We own and operate our airports within a 35-mile radius of Minneapolis-St. Paul City Hall. So overlapping concentric circles, that's our jurisdiction given to us by you. We talk about the 7-county metro area, but in fact, it incorporates pieces of about 13 different counties. Today, we operate one of the nation's largest airport systems, with a total of 7 airports in the metro area. The next page simply shows you where those airports are located. I talked about them a moment ago. Total operations, that is takeoffs and landings, about 1 million aircraft operations a year in our metropolitan area, and a safety record that we're extremely proud of. But that, Madam Chair, is an introduction, and many of you may have heard that in the bus tour if you were able to take the time, although I recognize the new faces. I'd like to take an opportunity now to introduce Susan Warner Dooley. Susan Warner Dooley has joined the staff in the past year. She was from Miami, where she was one of the deputy directors there. She is our deputy executive director for finance administration. She's going to talk to you about how the MAC generates its money, how we manage our money, how we use the money, and answer questions that you may have.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Susan Warner Dooley. Madam Chair, members, there is a presentation also in your folder that talks about the finances. The first page is what appears to be a very complicated chart that is actually, hopefully I can simplify it, lays out how our money comes in and goes out. The first column on the left is our operating budget. It deals with our operating funds that come in, the breaks and charges that we get from the airlines, the concession revenues that we earn, as well as interest earnings. And then we use those monies first to pay our bills. We pay the salaries, our contracts, the professional services, other supplies. That's how we first use our money. Any money that is left over, we then apply it to pay the debt service that we have outstanding. And I'll give you a few more details on the outstanding debt service in a few minutes. And then money that's left over after we've paid our debt service is used to pay construction projects. We bring in not only the dollars that we generate, we issue bonds to raise money for the debt for our construction. And then we also use passenger facility charges, which is a $4.50 charge that's applied as part of the ticket for passengers flying out of Minneapolis. And we also get some grants from the federal government and from the state government. These are grants that are associated with aviation uses. So it would be like jet fuel taxes, ticket taxes. Those monies will come back to the airports, and we can use those on construction projects as well. So that divides out a general overview of how the funds flow at the MAC. The next page gives a pie chart on the operating revenues. You'll see that actually less than one half of our total operating revenues come from airline rates and charges. 34% is our budget for 2007. 45% of our revenues are coming from concessions and commercial operations, which I'll describe a little bit more. And then 21% is coming from other sources. The next page shows the airline rates and charges, and these are the payments the airlines make to us. The landing fees, we charge $1.98 for each 1,000 pounds of landed weight for each aircraft that lands at MSP. So, you know, whatever the aircraft decides to hold, that's the charge we charge for the landing. For terminal space that they rent, we charge them a per square foot rate. For when they park out on the ramp That's what the apron, yeah. We charge a fee. And there's other miscellaneous, fees and charges. These charges are all based on our costs. There's formulas as part of the airline agreement that we have, and that's how our charges that we charge the airlines each year are set up. Next page talks about the concessions and how those charges, those are actually charges that are set up in terms of our terminal concessions by setting out a competitive process, and concessionaires will bid what percentage of revenues they will pay to us. The largest component of our concession revenues are our parking revenues that we generate from customers that park in our parking garages. You'll see it's 61% of the concession revenues, almost $70 million we're expecting to earn this year from parking operations at MSP. Other revenues that we generate include building rentals from a miscellaneous hangar or other buildings at the airport. We get approximately $4.5 million from our reliever airports as far as the total dollars that are coming in. You see utilities, reimbursed expenses, miscellaneous other expenses that are coming in. The operating expenses that we pay each year. First of all, there's depreciation, which is really not cash going out, but that is how we keep track of the amounts that we have invested in our assets. But when you look at what I would call the true cash operating expenses, of that, half of it is going towards personnel. As Mr. Hamill mentioned, we have an extremely lean staff, probably the leanest on a per and plane passenger basis of any the large hub airports, but still half of our budget is going towards personnel costs. Then we have maintenance costs, operating contracts, a variety of miscellaneous other expenses. As I mentioned, we are operating our headcount. It has grown over the past few years, but we also have had our the runways as well as the terminal spaces greatly expanded over time as well. So we continue to run with a lean staff of 560 FTEs. Next page shows the debt that we've issued. Since 1998, with the development of our 2010 plan, again, the additional runway, the new Humphrey Terminal, the expansion of the Lindbergh Terminal, we have issued about $1.6 billion worth of additional debt. But it's something that's very much was part of our plan when we were going forward, and something that we've been able to manage quite well. The next page shows the annual debt service payments. Again, they've grown, but as part of our operating budget, and so we are recovering those amounts through our charges to the airlines as well as concession revenues, and still having plenty of additional money at the end of the year. Next page talks about, shows the 2010 plan and how it's divided out. It's approximately $2.8 million as part of this total plan, with almost 30% of it going towards airfield and ramp projects, 22% of it going towards terminal projects, 15% of it going to parking and roadways, 9% of it is slated for noise, reliever airports, 7%, and other, almost 20%. To fund that capital program, we have received some minor federal grants, some state grants, and again, these are aviation-related grants. We've used revenue bonds. We've used passenger facility charges to pay construction costs as well as to pay for debt. And again, that's the $450 charge that's added onto the tickets, and some commercial paper, as well as we've used our own funds, almost $340 million of our own funds to pay for some of that construction. Looking at the next page, looks at how Mr. Hamill mentioned we've grown over time, and this just shows how our airline passengers have grown. When we negotiated our airline agreement back in 1999, we had a certain forecast of where we thought our passengers would be heading. Obviously, with 2001, we took a dip, which we've recovered. And then with the bankruptcy and just some of the dynamics in the airline industry, we are looking at continued growth at MSP, but at a lower rate than what was forecast back in 1999. And then the final page is looking at what we call our airline cost per in-plane passenger. one of the ways we like to measure ourselves and sort of benchmark ourselves with other airports is looking at the charges to the airlines, the airline payments, that's the airline cost is what we call it, and divide that by the number of enplaned passengers. And you can, it's something that airports monitor and benchmark themselves with. Airlines like to monitor. You can see that we have tried to manage our costs very very well. When you look at some of the dip that we had in 2003 through 2005, that's even when the passenger levels were down. Now with the new construction coming online and recovering some of those costs, our passenger costs per plane passenger were going up, and that will lead into some of the things that we were facing as we went into the negotiation of the new proposal.
Madam Chair, if I may just refresh your memory for a moment. In 1989, the legislature passed the Airport Planning Act. That was the action that directed the Airports Commission to take a look at the need for future aviation services in the metropolitan communities through the year 2020. That was what became known as the dual-track airport planning process, where we looked at building a new airport on a greenfield site versus expanding the airport at the current location. And if you recall, it was back in 1996 when the legislature decided to keep the airport at its current location and expand the current site. The $3 billion or approaching $3 billion program is the financing that Susan's talking about when she talks about the 2010 plan. And in fact, all of those programs have now been basically completed, which includes expansion of the Lindbergh Terminal, the Sea Concourse, the A, B, and part of the Sea Concourse, the new inbound outbound railway system. We've doubled the parking capacity on the inbound railway to something near about 17,000 parking spaces. We built the Humphrey Terminal building, Humphrey building parking facilities, the new north-south runway, and of course the LRT contribution underneath the airport from downtown Minneapolis to the Mall of America with an underground station at the Lindbergh Terminal and non-grade station at the Humphrey Terminal building. That's the 2020 plan we talk about. That's the near $3 billion that we've spent and now been accomplished between 1996 and 2007. All of these improvements are paid for by the users of the airport, and this is the bottom line for us. We're a government agency that does not use general tax funding from citizens of Minnesota or general taxes from the federal government to pay for these improvements. In fact, the users pay for these improvements by using our facility. When you buy an airline ticket, a percentage of your ticket tax goes into the Federal Aviation Trust Fund. We apply to try to recover and get back a portion of Minneapolis-St. Paul's contribution to that fund, and we do so by having projects that are qualified and approved by the Federal Aviation Administration. If you come to Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport and park your car, you know it's expensive, but if you park your car on our ramp, that revenue is part of how we pay for those ramps and pay for the amenities at the airport. If you buy a magazine or a lunch in the terminal building as you travel, that contributes to our revenues as well. Bottom line here, Madam Chair, members, is that users pay for the operation of the airport, not the general taxpayer, and that's why we don't come up here and ask you for funding or financing or appropriations authorization to run the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport or the airport system itself.
Okay, excuse me, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have a question looking at this 2010 plan project summary. When you look at the noise, it's 9%. And with the recent kind of ruling, or maybe the ruling isn't over with, I'm not sure just how that's going to shake out, where there would have to be more mitigation efforts on some of the homes. Is that going to fit within that 9%, or are you going to have to raise the $4.75 ticket charge, taking it personally, because I'm going to... I like to fly.
Mr. Hamill. The figure, the 9%, represents $244,800,000 spent thus far. That's money we've actually spent as part of the 2010 plan.
Or
projecting to spend, planning to spend. If we were to lose litigation and directed by the courts to spend, I don't know how much money, but it would be a lot. That would be above what we've already forecast and projected as part of this calculation.
Representative
Gelney. Thanks, Madam Chair. I was just wondering how much that would be above and how you would recoup those costs, if you have
Mr.
a plan for that.
Madam Chair, President Scalzi, I think that depends on what the judge determines to be the appropriate level of mitigation, how far out, what level of investment in each property. But I can say that the range could go as high as $330 million if we had to do a full noise mitigation package out to the 60 dB contour. So we're talking substantially more dollars.
Okay, please continue.
I'm sorry?
Mr. Hamill, go ahead.
Well, I was simply going to say that money would then come through airline rates and charges and through passenger facility charges. These PFCs that we talk about is the $4.50 added to every departing passenger's ticket that we keep here locally as you depart from the airport.
All right. Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may, Tom Anderson is the Commission's General Counsel. He is here to talk with you today about our airline rates and charges negotiations, which are coming to a conclusion. I would say that the Commission voted last week to support the overall negotiated package. However, to date, the airlines have not responded in the affirmative. We're waiting for additional discussion with the airlines on their response to the overall proposal that's offered.
All
Tom
right.
Anderson.
Please go ahead. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thomas Anderson. I'm the attorney for the Metropolitan Airports Commission on the staff. As Mr. Hamill and Ms. Warner-Dooley indicated, the legal relationship with the airlines is governed by a series of leases and rules, regulations, and ordinances that the MAC has adopted. In one sense, MAC operates as the governmental entity regulating the airport, but we also own all the land, and so we are also the landlord. And so this dual relationship gives us some flexibility and complexity in terms of our relations with the airlines. Our principal relationship, the principal legal and financial relationship with the airlines, though, is governed by a series of leases that have been negotiated and signed by Northwest and the other large airlines that serve our community, United, the US Air, Delta, and so on. There's 21 in all who are signatory airlines. And those leases establish the financial terms under which the airlines pay for the space that they occupy and the terms and conditions under which they occupy the space. In addition, and somewhat unique to me, and that's typical of how airports are operated throughout the country, we have been placed in a unique role, however, by the legislature when in 1991, through special legislation, the Airports Commission was directed to negotiate a financial assistance package to Northwest Airlines. The so-called state loan that many of you may know about is in fact a Metropolitan Airports Commission obligation to certain bondholders that is backed up by a series of leases and agreements that we have with Northwest that requires them to repay that financial assistance that was provided back in 1991. And so when we entered the period of the of financial stress in the airline industry, which of course has been a very cyclical industry, our both financial and operational concerns centered both around our normal operating relationship, our leases, our terminal building lease and so on, and this special relationship we have as a result of the 1991 legislation that was adopted. And so that's sort of the background for how we got into the lease negotiations. If you look at the materials, which are the overview of the proposal to increase long-term financial stability and air service competitiveness, I'd really point you to page 3 as a place to begin, because since September 11th, and indeed really with the economic downturn that preceded that, there is a new economic reality facing aviation. As you can imagine, September 11th impacted the aviation industry probably as much or more as any other sector of our economy, with the combination of increased fuel prices, increased security costs, and at least at times depressed demand by passengers. This has been a very troubled time for the airline industry. And if you look at that chart, just think of the major network airlines that have filed for bankruptcy since 2000, including Northwest Airlines. The dozens of low-cost carriers such as Masaba or Sun Country or ATA or others who are providing an alternative way to fly beyond simply the traditional network carriers. And then, of course, the all-cargo carriers that are, that maybe passes a little bit below the surface in terms of our the normal passenger's consciousness about what the airport provides, but really is an important part of the industry and the support that the airport provides to the community that that demands air service. The airline industry has been in substantial financial trouble, and you can see the charts. Going back to the 1947 time frame, a series of modest profits followed by times of huge losses, and the industry still has not recovered despite the hopes of optimism that we read in the paper. There are still serious problems in the airline industry, and those are continuing into the future. So when Northwest filed for bankruptcy on September 14, 2005, our airport faced several challenges. One was the specific legal complications that arose as a result of our financial relationship with Northwest Airlines. Certain rights, as you know, that that companies in bankruptcy have that they don't have if they're not in bankruptcy. And because of the complex relationship that we have with the airlines and the importance of Northwest, who pays about 80% of the airline rates and charges portion of our payments, simply from a financial point of view, let alone from an operational perspective, this bankruptcy has really been critical to the airport. That, on top of the fact that the industry has been fundamentally shifted, put our board in a position of saying we need to look at our leases with the airlines and what we can do to improve our relationship. And on page 2, identified some of the principal goals that we identified as we went into these negotiations, which began really after the bankruptcy filing in September of 2005 and have been really carried on in earnest since for the last 13 months. But they break down, I would say, into four principal areas: financial objectives, legal objectives, operational objectives, and, for lack of a better word, public policy objectives. And so as we approach this negotiation, we attempted to address each of those areas in a systematic manner, with the end result being a financial package which, while substantial in the judgment of our finance staff and ultimately of our board, is something that the airport can do to address these financial, legal, and operational objectives. Let me give you sort of a broad framework for what we did and why we did and what specifically I think the public got out of these negotiations. And then after you hear that, walk through some of the specifics. And I'm happy to go into as much or as little detail as the committee wants, or if you want additional briefings after, of course, we're happy to provide that as well. Financially, it was important to us to do something that didn't just affect Northwest Airlines, but that benefited all airlines. Even though Northwest is the proverbial 800-pound gorilla in the Twin Cities, in fact, it's the airport's job to create a level playing field for all airlines, and the airlines insist on that. They, as a both a legal and a practical matter, they are there to ensure that the airport creates a level playing field for them in which to operate. And ultimately, of course, in a deregulated system, then it's up to the passengers to decide what airlines they want to fly. So that was one of the objectives we started in. We weren't going to do just a relief package for Northwest Airlines, which might have been justified if we were looking at this strictly from the perspective of the bankruptcy of Northwest. We said, no, we want a package that applies even-handedly. Second, we wanted to build in key financial protections which we do not have today, and we will not have unless this proposal is ultimately adopted and implemented. So those financial protections are areas of exposure that we believe we have under the current agreement that we think can be improved upon, and we believe that this proposal will, in fact, improve upon. In terms of the legal issues that we that we were forced to confront are the fact that in bankruptcy, a company that is a tenant has the right to assume or reject its leases. And without going into a great deal of the specifics of that, it means that if you think of the Gap, which may have hundreds of leases all over the country, it can look selectively and say, we're going to reject these 50 leases and walk away from those obligations and limit our legal exposure to those landlords and try to focus our new business plan on the remaining leases. Well, airlines have that same right. And so an airline looking at its various lease arrangements throughout the country can decide as part of its plan for reorganization whether it wants to continue to pay on those leases or not. And if they decide to reject the leases, they essentially can walk away from their future obligations, and there's a damage calculation that you're entitled to as a landlord, but it's limited to, in the worst case, the most is 3 years of additional rent. So it puts a real severe cap on what airports can obtain, and certainly in the context of a large airline like Northwest, the rejection of the leases that Northwest has in Minneapolis, St. Paul, would have a significant financial effect on the airport. So one of the key objectives we went into this negotiation with was that we wanted something that would put Northwest Airlines in a position where it would assume those legal obligations that it had already entered into. And by assuming those leases, that means it would emerge from bankruptcy with those obligations intact. Number two, that is especially important in the context of this state loan that I talked about. We call it the GO-15. You might hear that terminology if you follow this issue closely, which is a series of bonds that we issued to finance and ultimately refinance this loan package. And the airport is on the hook for those obligations, and it's only backstopped by the promise of Northwest to pay those to pay the debt service on those bonds, essentially, as those payments become due. And then it's also backed up by collateral. So we have a very complex financial relationship, much like a secured lender would have in an arrangement. And so one of the key objectives we had in this bankruptcy, a second key objective, was to obtain Northwest's assumption of those GO-15 obligations to continue to make all those payments. And so unlike other secured creditors, we have had throughout the course of the bankruptcy now since September of 2005 continued to receive payments from Northwest Airlines on those obligations. And that is in significant part because of these ongoing negotiations and our linking any financial relief to their commitment to continue to pay those obligations. And so, and like I'll have to be candid, like many negotiations, there's of course a give and take, and one of the things Northwest said is that we're going to continue to make those payments, but we're going to reserve the right to attempt to get out of them if this whole deal falls apart. And so they have made conditional payments since September of 2005. So now we have a substantial balance of money that has been paid over to us to support these obligations, but it's all, again, tied up in our ability to force Northwest put Northwest in a position where it's going to exit its bankruptcy with this obligation intact, and then all those contingencies that they placed on these payments will go away. So that was kind of the second legal objective. There's others as well, and I won't go into the specifics now, but the whole goal here is to make sure that and the proposal that was ultimately adopted in principle by our board last week makes it clear that none of the benefits to any airlines happen unless Northwest Airlines emerges from bankruptcy with all of the obligations that we worked into the agreement intact. And so there's no issue of we're making some sort of commitment to them and they're going to take that and they're going to try to get out of that. We worked very closely with our bankruptcy counsel. We have several firms who we've been retained, not just for the Northwest bankruptcy. As you can see from that list of airlines in bankruptcy, the bankruptcy practice at the airport has been thriving for some time, and that's something that, as the airport attorney, I've had to become pretty knowledgeable about over the years, simply because it's a reality in our business. The third area that we were trying to accomplish were to achieve certain key operational objectives. Competition is, of course, a key element, and as at least I think our board has viewed it, and perhaps most of the state views it, we want our cake and we want to eat it too. We want the benefits of a hub where we can fly nonstop to any community in this country or in many communities in the world without having to connect through some other hub, but we also want competition from other carriers to put a check on that large hub, and those economic forces are constantly in tension. One of our key objectives is to make sure, for example, that we have the ability to accommodate any airline that wants to come into our community with the good with gates, with ticket counter, with other facilities that they need. That has always been a key objective of ours. We've had those provisions in our leases going back to the 1980s and 90s. We've strengthened those provisions significantly by this agreement. And so that's one of the key things we tried to accomplish, and I believe we have accomplished as part of this. If you know the airport well, there's the D concourse is a series of gates. It used to be the beginning of the green concourse. Those gates under this proposal would all become what are called short-term gates that we could take away from Northwest, that we would lease to Northwest, but they would take back from them on essentially 60 days notice if we needed it to accommodate a new entrant. And so even though there are substantial rights that the airlines have, we needed and believe, I think, that we have obtained the ability to accommodate changing economic conditions and new entrants who want to come into our market. Also, as a result of our board's action, we put explicitly on the table the commitment from Northwest to maintain its hub and headquarters in the Twin Cities. That is something, if you have followed this issue at all, were two of the public policy covenants that were negotiated in 1991 and are in the GO15 documents that I was speaking about before. By this proposal, we are going to link those, we are going to, first of all, strengthen those commitments substantially, and second, link them not just to the GO15 loan and the Northwest payment obligations there, but to the financial benefits that Northwest is receiving as a result of this package. So the commitment to maintain the hub and the headquarters here are linked to Northwest's receipt of the financial benefits from this package. There's been a lot of discussion about the size of the financial relief package that's been provided. And if you turn to page 4, I want to try to put that in context for you. That chart shows in the blue line, the blue diamond line, the current payments that are paid by all of the airlines from 2006 through 2020, which would be the term of the lease under this new proposal. The purple block represents the reduction in rent from that line that would be received by the airlines, the reduced rent that we would receive and the benefit to all the airlines as a result of this proposal. And while, as you can see, it's substantial, I would point out two points. Number one, the total reduction is about 11% in total from what the obligations are that the airlines have to pay between now and 2020. And secondly, it is, at least to some extent, front-end loaded. The relief is applied essentially in the first 10 years, and by the mechanism that we adopted, by the time we get to 2015 or 2016, the benefit to the airlines essentially is eliminated, and we go back to about the same level of rates and charges that we have today with, as I had mentioned earlier, significantly additional financial protections than we have today. So we think we're getting some benefits as a result of this package that we don't have today.
Excuse me if I could ask a question. Airlines have the ability to go into bankruptcy and then come out and then go back in. Would these protections be in place in the event of a second Northwest Airline bankruptcy?
That's a real critical issue, Madam Chair, and something that's very difficult to predict. We obtained a great deal of advice from bankruptcy counsel on the way that we could structure this agreement so as to prevent, to as to protect us in the event of a second bankruptcy, and we attempted to negotiate some specific provisions to deal with that. But one of the complications is that in bankruptcy, so much is discretionary with the judge in the particular case. And we know Judge Gropper in the New York Bankruptcy Court, who's handling the current bankruptcy. In a second bankruptcy filing by Northwest, there's certainly no obligation to go back to Judge Gropper or even to the Southern District of New York. And so it's very difficult to predict how these things will be addressed in bankruptcy. So we attempted to address that issue, but I would not say that this is an airtight proposal with respect to second bankruptcies. That there are some economic realities here, frankly, that no amount of legal drafting or maneuvering is going to be able to solve. What we've attempted to do is put the airport on a firmer financial footing than it's been on, and of course the economics of the industry looking out 5, 10, 15, 20 years are going to be pretty hard to gauge.
A follow-up to that would be, so then with front-end loading, the discount, is that a concern at all, or did the board talk about whether or not that was a concern? Because if you front-end load and then they do go back into bankruptcy, there's additional risk?
Madam Chair, there was a great deal of debate and divergence of opinion among our board. There were some who wanted to provide simply 2 or 3 years of sort of short-term relief to deal with the issue, right, the crisis of the day, not to try to deal with any of these systemic problems that the staff had identified in the agreements, just to kind of deal with the financial relief package. There were some who said, no, let's just level this thing out and not to do too much up front, you know, which is kind of the opposite direction. And so this does represent a compromise, but not a unanimous position. But again, a fair amount of debate about that.
Okay. Please continue. Go ahead.
Thank you. The next page on 5 translates this into the ways the airlines look at this, which is not what they pay us, but you know what it costs them. And the cost per enplaned passenger is just another way to look at it. This is how airlines kind of benchmark airports and how we benchmark ourselves to find out if we're providing cost-effective airport services to the airlines. Because that is one of many, but certainly one significant factor that an airline is going to look at when it decides whether or not it wants to fly into the Twin Cities or increase its flying in the Twin Cities. What are the underlying costs? Obviously, they're also concerned about what kind of revenue they can produce on those flights. But cost is a key driver for their decision-making. And so, as you can see, the proposal in the short term lowers the cost per enplaned passenger significantly from in 2007, what would have been almost $7 per enplaned passenger to more like $5.50, and then again, much like in the previous chart, that gap continues through 2015 or 16, and then continues on. The method that we used to adopt this and some of the issues of protection are in this next chart on page 6, so it's just a little bit busy. And I would be happy to go through it, Madam Chair, if you wish. I'll just give a brief synopsis if you want to understand the mechanics. And then if there are more detailed questions, I'd be happy to answer them. We currently charge there are two categories of changes that we made to the financial model. One is the way in which we collect for capital projects, and the other is what's been called the revenue sharing of concession revenues. This chart on page 6 deals with the recovery of capital projects. Our airport has always charged for capital projects based on what's called the depreciation and an interest model. And that model says if you have a capital project, you look at the cost, you depreciate that cost over some period of time, you include some sort of imputed interest cost, and that's how much you charge on a given year, much like you were doing in a kind of a straightforward accounting. It really has nothing to do with what the costs are to us, what our debt service is, which is the actual cost to the airport of that debt. It's kind of leveled out. It's an accounting methodology. And it turns out we are one of the last, if not the last, airport to use the depreciation and interest model. As a result, what we had in 2006 was a situation where we were collecting substantially more in the depreciation and interest charge than we were required to pay out in debt service to the bondholders. So in other words, if we do a capital project, we go out and borrow money
and then we charge the airlines, and then the rent from the airlines presumably goes to help pay the bondholders. There was a huge gap to our favor in the depreciation and interest model, but in the context of an industry that was struggling, we thought that this was an area that merited some investigation as to whether we could afford to lower our charge from this depreciation and interest model to an actual cost-based approach or a debt service approach. So that was one of the fundamental changes that we investigated and ultimately endorsed as part of this package, to move away from depreciation and interest and charge the airlines just for the debt service. Now, one of the problems with just charging, now one of the advantages to that is that although the depreciation line is above debt service today, those lines cross in the future. And so one of the benefits to us is by locking into a debt service recovery methodology, we were going to guarantee that our payments were going to be repaid by the airlines because they were all going to be responsible to pay the debt service. The airport obviously isn't in it to make money. We're in it to provide an important public service, public resource to the community. To the extent we don't have a group of shareholders that we can send money back to. In fact, by federal law, all the money has to stay on the airport. It's legally obligated to remain in the airport system. And so this seemed like a way that we could afford to provide relief to the airlines. So we made that proposal, and so that's the kind of the shift from the black boxes on the top down to the blue line in terms of what we were going to be collecting on debt service. But we said, no, that doesn't provide enough protection, and so we added a cushion, and that's the yellow. The yellow is kind of a charge back of $15 million additional beyond our debt service that the airlines will pay for us. And that $15 million per year escalates at 3% per year throughout the term of this agreement. So there's a cushion of $15 million on top of the debt service that we are going to be collecting from the airlines each year, with that number growing as the term goes. So the goal of this was to replace depreciation with debt service, but to give us this cushion of protection by the internal cash from airline charges. So that was the first element of relief to the airlines. I apologize if it's complicated. Let me just take a breath there and see if anybody has any questions about that, and certainly feel free to call or ask us later if you have others. The second big category is the concessions revenue rebate. And we didn't provide all the backup to you, but we investigated in detail what other airports do. And in fact, if you think about the airport with concessions revenue, it isn't much different than a stadium deal. There's the rent from the major tenant, and then there's all the concessions revenue that comes in from the public that uses those facilities. Well, the airport is much the same way, and the concessions revenue is a significant portion of the revenue that we receive. And so we looked at that as a possible source of revenue sharing with the airlines. It was very controversial in our community because we haven't thought of ourselves as doing it, although in fact we have done it since before I got there. It started back in 1970 where we began revenue sharing with the airlines, in particular with Northwest Airlines. And our key competitors share all of their revenue. Detroit, 100% of their concession revenue is shared with the airlines. Chicago, 100% of their concession revenue is shared with the airlines. So given that, we felt that it was prudent to investigate whether we could afford and would be willing to begin a revenue sharing approach. And we developed one that ultimately met with the approval, and it's listed here. The yellow box represents all our total concession revenue. The blue line below it is the selected concessions that we identified as being willing to share: food and beverage, merchandise, and auto rental. And then we said a certain percentage of that concession revenue we would share. Roughly 25%, that number goes up if we go above projection, and it goes down and is eliminated if we go substantially below that projection. So the end result is we end up sharing about 8% of our concession revenue with the airlines, which we felt was modest, prudent, and something that we felt we could afford to do in the context of the kind of crisis in this industry. Where this leaves us at the end is lowering our costs to the airlines. And if you look on page 8, it's a list of all the major airports, all the large hub airports in 2005, and the cost per plane passengers.
Okay, I do have two questions. First, Representative Beard.
Well, Madam Chair, it relates to this chart that Mr. Anderson, I believe, is going to show us right now. And it's not so much a question as an observation, a comment in my 5 years of history here and having some direct relationship or discourse with the MAC. I think it's admirable that the MAC has looked at this overview of where we stand vis-a-vis the other major commercial airports and has put a standard into place that we want to be in the bottom end of in-plane passenger costs. I think that's good public policy. However, I'm going to complain here for just a moment that this standard was not used whenever we applied it to the rates and charges applied to the reliever airport system, when the previous board, the previous chair, deliberately, I guess, split the airport system apart and called it the big airport, and oh, we have these little six little ones too, the relievers. The rates and charges that were in place then had been adjusted by the previous administration, governor, and his team, but they did just exactly the opposite. And I guess this isn't a question as much as this. I want you to know we paid attention. I didn't care for it, and I want the members of this committee to know that they did exactly the opposite. They took a national standard of where reliever airports were in other metropolitan areas, determined we were actually in about the bottom third, and then set about to make sure we got into the top third, or at least well above the standard. And there were some pretty onerous rates and charges increases that were given to the reliever airports, particularly the businesses and commercial operators on those airports. I know that the current chair has been trying to address this, but if you could just kind of take that message back there, that some of us still are smarting over that. And if this standard works for the big guys, it would really be cool if it could work for the little guys, too. Thanks.
Thank you. Comment? Mr. Hamill?
Yeah, go ahead. Madam Chair, Representative, I would characterize the rates and charges on reliever airports a bit differently in that up until about, say, 7 or 8 years ago, Minneapolis-St. Paul Metropolitan Airports Commission did not change its charges to the reliever airport tenants in over 30 years. And in fact, if a person leased land on our airports to build a private aircraft hangar, they paid 2 or 3 cents per square foot per year rental charge, which was absolutely unheard of anywhere in the nation in a metropolitan area. And what the commission did prior to this previous administration that Representative Biz is talking about, they started to raise those rates to become more in line with most typical metropolitan areas in the United States. And I would have to tell you that today, I would argue that today the reliever airport tenants pay what would be fairly close to on par with what other airports charge in large metropolitan areas around the country. If you're an aircraft owner and you have a hangar on an airport in St. Louis or an airport in Kansas City or an airport in Atlanta, what you pay to be on those airports is about what you're paying today. I think, however, in all fairness to Representative Baird, the rate of increase from 2 cents to 30 to 35 cents per square foot over the course of less than 10 years is a dramatic increase in cost, one that was not anticipated by those tenants, and it has been a difficult ladder to climb to come up on par. Also, while we talk about our airport charges to the airlines as being reduced, Tom will talk in a moment about how we stack up on average with other airports around the country, and I think it puts some balance. But I'm not be arguing with Representative Baird. I'm simply saying that I think that there's been a dramatic change for our tenants in Minneapolis-St. Paul. They've screamed, and they screamed loudly, and we've heard them. I don't think you'll see increases in the near future added to those current charges that have been adjusted. But it is not completely out of line with what you'd find most anyplace else in the country for a private aircraft owner to pay for land to build a hangar.
Follow up.
Well, Madam Chair, we obviously, or Mr. Hamill and I have had this discussion before, so we're kind of just going through it again just for your benefit as well. Again, I just reiterate my contention that the rush to be in the bottom half for MSP is admirable. And I'm sorry that there was not a rush to keep the relievers in the bottom half. Instead, we tried to get them into the top half. And the raw land prices for just private owners like myself isn't really the discussion. We realized that there was a pretty good deal going on. But the cost of the commercial and corporate operators, that's the one I think that their budgets took a real shock, because I think there was some overreaching going on. So what's done is done. I'll just share it with the committee and with the team here that if they could find the wherewithal to get back below the 50th percentile, you'd probably get back on some Christmas card lists somewhere.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, if you have some difficulty with MAC or Northwest or others in your area, you should live in Grand Rapids, where we lost all service in 30-day notice, no matter what. And it became a kind of a self-fulfilling, so I don't have a great deal of empathy, I think, for some of the airline services that they provide. But in that discussion always, I've heard all the time from mostly Northwest that our embargoed price was so much higher than all the rest of their hubs. And I assume that Memphis, is that MCO?
MCO is Orlando. This would be MEM.
Where it's not on there. Where is it?
No.
Where are there? I mean, that's a major airport. I was looking for it.
MCO should be.
No, it's not.
If you're looking for a Memphis, Madam Chair, if I may.
Mr. Hamill.
Representative Solberg, if you're looking for Northwest Airlines operates out of three hubs in the United States: Minneapolis, St. Paul, which is their world headquarters; Detroit, which is a large operation comparable in size to Minneapolis, St. Paul; and Memphis, Tennessee, which is significantly smaller, about one-third the size of Detroit and Minneapolis. Those are the three hub airport operations that Northwest operates from. Memphis is not listed as a large hub airport because it's only a third the size of MSP. What you have on page 8 of the handout are the FAA-defined large hubs. There should be 32 or 33 airports listed there, of which Detroit, Minneapolis, and Orlando, as you mentioned, MCO, are part of them. MEM, Memphis, would not be on that list because it's not listed as one of those large hubs.
Madam Chair, what is the embargo cost per passenger in Memphis?
Mr. Hamill.
Madam Chair, my point is that Northwest has always said that Minneapolis-St. Paul was so much higher than Detroit and so much higher than everybody else. And it's okay, probably, Representative Beard, to be in the bottom, but when you look at the Boston and Seattle and Philadelphia and others, obviously that they're paying. Northwest is paying when they land there to operate those airports as well, and so they're paying a sizable amount. So our funds, our passengers, are when they fly into Miami, are paying a substantial amount, and to help Miami be able to maintain its airport. And I'm surprised and shocked when I saw this chart, I knew we'd be way up there on the top, according to Northwest publicity, that we were much higher. And I found Detroit and. Gosh, we were just about the same as Detroit, and now we're going to be lower than Detroit. So this is an interesting chart for me anyway.
This is
Mr. Hamill.
Let Mr. Anderson go ahead and speak.
Go ahead, Mr. Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I think we've had the discussion about this chart. It really gets you into the airports, and as I think we can all, it's like a lot of comparables. You pick the ones you're most interested in. The ones that we tend to look at are the northern tier airports that operate similarly to us, like Detroit and Chicago, where you're dealing with snow plowing, where you have a large number of operations. And clearly, you can see the 2006 level was roughly on a par with Detroit, and in 2007, as we were showing before in another format, was going up. This proposal will drive us down significantly below, although all in the context of being, if you will, in the lower middle or in the middle of the cost per in-plane passenger for airports across the country. So I would concur with Representative Solberg's observation about where we are, where we were going, and now where we've headed. But we're certainly
we're in a very narrow range of relatively certainly low cost compared to the JFKs or Miamis or San Franciscos.
Well, Madam Chair, I know Miami doesn't have hardly any snowplow equipment, and Orlando sure doesn't. Flown into Orlando, it's a nice airport, but it's you know, it's not the world's best airport in the world. It's got nice people moving machines, but that's okay, I guess. But I'm just shocked and dismayed by the rhetoric that Northwest has always said about their landing fees, and found out that there was not much difference between Detroit and Minneapolis, and we're way down in the bottom. So,
Mr. Hamill.
Madam Chair, Representative Holt Silber, if I may. If you take a look at the large, the 33 large hub airports of the United States, man, those are really our competitors. Those are the airports that we want to compete for our service. The average cost for an airline company to transport one passenger through an airport is called cost per plane passenger. And that's the cost that costs Northwest Airlines for every single person that departs Minneapolis-St. Paul. If you look at the national average, that national average is around $9.50 per passenger. That's what it costs Delta, American, Northwest, all the carriers to transport one passenger through an airport on a national average. Those rates go as high as, for example, on this chart on the left-hand side, you'll see EWR, that's Newark in New York, at over $20 per passenger in plane costs. Miami, number two, it's somewhere in the area of about $18, $17.50, $18. By the way, Susan just joined us. She was the deputy director in the Miami airport, and came to us in last year. JFK, San Francisco, Denver, Boston, all these airports are above $10 per passenger. Minneapolis-St. Paul ranks down about around $6 or $7, dropping down to within the $5.50 range, making us one of the more competitive large airports in the nation. And from the Northwest perspective, for all that they have here and what they enjoy for our services and facilities, they're getting bargain rates at their headquarters, hometown airport, as part of their national system. In fact, our total rates in charge of Minneapolis-St. Paul as their headquarters, with all of their hangars and their facilities here, is less than 0.5% of their total airport costs worldwide. So I think Minneapolis-St. Paul is very competitive from that perspective. However, we are taking this action because we believe that we want to make ourselves even more competitive and take price out of the equation, deciding to serve Minneapolis-St. Paul as a market for competitors.
So just
Representative Tolbert.
When the Northwest negotiated with you and they threatened to possibly move the headquarters, were they picking Miami?
Well, let me be
That's a facetious question.
But it brings an important point, Madam Chair.
Mr. Hamill.
And I think this is important. We spent a year in negotiation with Northwest Airlines representing all of the carriers, and that's a very typical negotiating scenario. For example, in Dallas-Fort Worth, American Airlines does most of the negotiation for all the airlines that serve Dallas-Fort Worth. Because of the largest representative, and whatever's good for Americans is good for everybody else. Well, Minneapolis-St. Paul is good for Northwest, is probably good for everyone else as well. But I have to tell you in all honesty that never in our discussions with Northwest Airlines during the past year, and those discussions become quite intense at times, have they ever threatened to move their hub or move their headquarters. They did suggest that the hub size could fluctuate. And what we wanted to do is make sure we could guarantee those facilities stay in the Twin Cities because they're important to us. But Northwest did not use that as leverage. They were simply saying to us, look, we have choices in bankruptcy. We can either work out a deal with you folks to try to reduce our cost and avoid having to default or not make payments on our obligations. Or, in fact, the court would let us walk away from these obligations, shed ourselves of that responsibility, and start fresh. And we thought a year ago, we said, you know something? We know you're distressed. The industry's in tough shape. Let's sit down and talk. In the last year's negotiations with Tom Emerson, been talking with you today, where we try to reduce our costs to make ourselves more competitive and lowering the cost of government in the eyes of the airlines.
Representative,
I said my comments were facetious, but they also have a basis for it, because I was around when negotiations took place on the loan to Northwest.
The same.
There
together.
So there is a little bit of basis for my facetiousness.
All right.
If that's a word.
Thank you. Well, and if I could get you to wrap up, because we do have a few other questions that are not on this presentation, and so we want to.
That's really it, Madam Chair. The agreement in principle was approved by our board with a approval of a memorandum of understanding last Wednesday. The next step will be to prepare the legal documents that are that will implement this and to present them to all 21 airlines who need to sign these agreements, and that will be some amount of discussion, no doubt, because the airlines will want to see the details associated with that. And then also our board has said we want to see the final documents as well. So documents will have to be reviewed and approved by all the airlines, by our board, and then in addition by the Northwest Airlines Bankruptcy Court, which we've made as a special condition to this deal going forward.
All right. Thank you. With that, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I have a question for you quick, and that is today's agenda item, I think, just said the MAC presentation, which we got. You probably said this at the beginning of the meeting. When are we going to hear all the bills related to the MAC?
Representative Lincheski, we only have a few right now, so if members have those, they should get them in, and then we'll schedule it. We do have a hearing scheduled for the Metropolitan Council, one day set aside already, but we don't yet have the day set aside because we only have a couple. So, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know there are some bills in other committees that are probably making their way here, and I know some that are not yet drafted, but I just thought I'd ask, and so maybe, Madam Chair, it's not appropriate for me to ask anything other than what's been discussed here, but if you can make that decision as I ask it. I do have a couple questions. One is, does Moody's and all the bond houses rate the airport? And what is your rating?
Mr. Hamill.
Yes, they do. Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch's, all three rating agencies do rate the airports, and they rate the base on a variety of factors to include the level of air service, commitment, their obligation tied to one carrier versus multiple carriers, the financial viability of the metropolitan community, the airport service, and so forth. Minneapolis, and also the overall financial performance and operation of the airport and its staff's experience and demonstrated ability to manage facilities. I'm pleased to say that Minneapolis-St. Paul has a double A-minus rating, which is one of the highest airport ratings in the nation, held by only about four or five airports in the United States. And all of the financial negotiations that we have done to this point, Madam Chair and Representatives, has been an attempt to try to ensure that we maintain our double A-minus rating as we work our way through this very complex financial negotiation with the airline. And we've been able to successfully do that. In fact, we've been told by the rating agencies that we, in fact, have done a solid job and don't jeopardize our financial future.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you. Thank you for that. So a double A-minus is high for airports.
Yes, it is.
Interesting. I wonder what you're thinking about that. I didn't know that, so I appreciate that. Is the cargo facility contemplated in Rosemount dead? What's happening with that?
Mr. Hamill.
Madam Chair, Representative Shinsky, it's not dead. I would tell you that it's been a slow process. Steve Anderson on our staff is our cargo expert. He also chairs the committee that works on the development of that. The governor has expressed an interest as recently as last year on moving forward with that process. There are a variety of organizations and individuals who still have a strong interest in it. That will be driven, however, by the market, by the interest of the various participants, which include the airlines, the freight handlers, the airport authority itself. I would have to do a little bit of research to actually find out specifically where we are in that process, but I know that it is not dead. It is just moving slowly.
Okay, I was just curious. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I've just been briefed.
Mr. Hamill.
Exciting news, Madam Chair, you're the first to hear. This Friday, evidently, is a kickoff plan with developers and interested parties to move that process forward. And looking at the marketing plan for the development of this concept. And if you're not familiar with this concept, it takes 10 seconds. It's moving the air freight cargo packaging off of the airport, theoretically moving it to a site in Rosemont, to a distribution center where the trucks bring all the picked up parcels and packages to the distribution center, back the truck up, unload the truck, load the pallets that are containers that are put in the airliners, roll those out the back onto another truck, and bring that truck to the airport with the loaded, secured containers to be put on board the airplane. What it means is that non-aviation activity, that is package loading and unloading, takes place off the airport, preserving airport capacity. Let that take place in Rosemont, and basically simplifies the overall cargo handling operation out of the airport. So we think there's great opportunity and potential, because the vast majority of our air freight goes to Chicago by truck as opposed to being flown out by airplane out of the Twin Cities.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Representative Chair Hillstrom. Can you tell me, you referenced the decision by the Minnesota legislature as it determined whether or not to build a new airport, and then in 96 came to agreement after the dual track planning process, which I was not here then, as you know, Mr. Hamill, and watched it from my city council perspective, as you well know.
I know where you were.
Yeah. And with all due respect to Representative Scalzi, you know that I feel strongly that those passenger facility charges are not high enough, and they should, in fact, take in the true cost of the noise that is being, the adverse impacts that are being absorbed by the communities that all the people who fly on planes enjoy but don't have to live with the noise. And so economists would call those the intangible actions that are happening in the economy, and they should be included in the price. So we would have a difference of agreement on that, a strong one, because we would like people to pay the true cost of flying for all the people who are living with it. But having said all that, that long process of the 96 decision by the Minnesota legislature and the decision as to whether or not you should insulate to a certain point that Representative Scalzi has raised, and you know, now that's in court, et cetera, et cetera. One other piece of that decision, when the Minnesota legislature, of which I was not a member, made the decision, no, let's not move the airport, let's stay where we are, and let's build a new runway. And you know the north-south process to pick the north-south runway was a very long and complicated process. And so when the north-south was determined, you also know that there were large impacts to the city I represent, and the whole Kelly Farm land swap for the Mall of America had to take place, and that was another long process, really, to help the MAC get the runway they wanted. Do you know, or can you provide for me later, what piece of that long wait was related to the airport choosing its runway and then choosing the length of its state and federal safety zones? I mean, how much of the time was the city of Bloomington held in abeyance and unable to develop that property due to the runway extension decision? And you may not know that. It seems to me it's 2 or 3 years. I know Lieutenant Governor Molnow was weighing in on the, you know, did we need 2 safety zones? And so there was a state component, an FAA component, and a MAC component. Mm-hmm. But as you know, Bloomington was the city sitting there kind of, you know, being impacted while everyone couldn't make up their mind. And so if you could take a guess at that, I'd love to hear what you think was the time frame.
Mr. Hamill.
Madam Chair, Vincheski, I'm not going to take a guess at that,
okay,
because you've asked a question that's a little bit different than what I've typically responded to. And rather than give you a time, I think what you're asking is how much time did Bloomington lose in development opportunity and tax revenues waiting for MAC and the state and the feds to define this protected zone off the end of that new runway,
yes,
before you could proceed?
Right.
And I quite frankly don't, I can't give you that number, but I will say this. That the line that's currently there, the area that's been cleared, the removal of the Sheridan Hotel, the filling stations, the Mall of America Grand Hotel, all of those facilities that were primarily hotel and some commercial properties have been completely removed, and that ground south that runway south of 494 is flat out to American Boulevard, which is probably a quarter of a mile farther south of 494. But from American Boulevard south, then it's the development is what existed is there, and certain limitations can be developed in the future. That American Boulevard location represents the federal guideline for noise or for safety, for safe operation of an airport. And that is what we have relied upon. And the debate that you're referring to is MnDOT's standard of what is safe. This is the federal criteria which is safe. And there was some debate and some issues there that did require, at that time, Lieutenant Governor, Commissioner of Transportation Molnow to make a determination, which she did, supporting the MAC's position. Let me do some background investigation for you and either call you or, if, Madam Chair, we can go through you and you can communicate this to the committee members as well. I just am not comfortable telling you whether it was 3 years or 4 years, or, but I understand, I think I understand your question. It's an interesting question. It's not one that we looked at quite that way.
Representative Winchester.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to ask another question. I just think it's worth the committee's just sort of pondering that question, because the true cost of that delay was not only borne by the surrounding city and the surrounding developers, and members may recall there had to be very difficult financial planning to create the land swap for the TIF lands for the Mall of America Phase 2, which legislators are looking at a proposal coming forward. And this is all part of that proposal. And members are not aware that this is all part of that proposal. And I think that it's important for committee members in the legislature to reflect on, and I think this is, the MAC would agree with me, that there is a huge cost savings to all residents of the metro by Bloomington allowing this delay to take place for a while, because the cost really would have shifted onto the property tax, which is the backbone of the MAC's fallback if they have to get in trouble financially, as they levy a property tax. They've never done it, but that would be where their authority fell. So as this whole financial piece was negotiated, the metro residents of the state of Minnesota were really relieved of hundreds of millions of dollars of potential having to pay back in litigation a developer's rightfully held property rights. And so that's kind of way out there, but members are hearing all these pieces as it relates to phase two, and they're all going to come together, and the MAC will be a part of that as well. So I just wanted to bring it up, and I think we need that information.
Madam Chair, Representative
Mr. Hamill.
Representative Lenchisky is bringing up, I think, maybe it's obvious to you, and that is that this whole process from 1989 to 1996 with the planning process, and from 1996 to today with construction and development, this whole process of the last 15 years is enormously complicated, incredibly expensive, and as you listen to the dialogue between the various parties that have been involved, you're going to hear abbreviations and acronyms and terminologies that are foreign that I don't think you could, quite frankly, always follow. But there are lots of ins and outs and a lot of nuances taking place. And this is one turn or twist that I've not actually taken a look at, and that is the economic impact upon the city of Bloomington. We've actually looked at it quite differently as being an opportunity to redevelop certain portions of Bloomington along the LRT line with the development of the Mall of America and so forth. Let me go back, do some homework, talk to the appropriate folks, and get back in response to the question that was asked.
Okay. I have also heard from others, as people are starting to introduce bills, that this committee may hear some bills regarding the legislative auditor's report that was done in 2003.
Yes.
So if you could maybe review that and maybe send us a memo about which items you've addressed from the auditor's report and which ones you haven't, so that as we're making decisions on bills later on, we will at least know which issues you have already taken care of.
Madam Chair, we in fact have a summary that we prepared in previous testimony following the release of that legislative program audit, legislative auditor's program audit of the MAC that went on for 9 months. This was not a strictly financial audit. It was a program audit of the MAC that went on for 9 months. And to be very frank with you, we were very, very pleased with the findings of that analysis. There were basically three critical findings or three primary findings, two of which didn't relate to the MAC. And I think that we've got a summary already prepared that we can make available to you. We'll update it because there are certain actions we have taken that probably need to be explained more clearly. But that was, quite frankly, a very, very successful thorough evaluation of the MAC that we will be happy to share with you.
Thank you. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hamill, a moment ago you referred to the Commissioner of Transportation signing off on some MAC land issues. More precisely, wasn't that the Joint Airport Zoning Board's decision that she actually signed off on, of which the MAC is only an advisory member, isn't it? I believe the cities around the airport actually control that board, which may be helpful to this discussion, which is why I brought it up.
Mr. Hamill.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, that's correct, Representative Beard. That's with the Joint Airport Zoning Board that was convened by the Airports Commission, but essentially controlled by all of the communities and MAC surrounding the airport, and in a very cooperative approach developed this ordinance that restricted development to some degree, and that was ultimately approved by the Commissioner of Transportation.
Further questions, Representative Lynchester.
To that point, though, Madam Chair, I don't want to leave the impression that just might have been put out there. There's really only one city, though, who had land impact, even though other cities had a say. As far as the runway that was decided, there was only one community that had land issues, and that was the community I represent.
Mr. Hamill.
Madam Chair, I would suggest that there's no question that the vast majority of land impacts were flying over Bloomington, roughly to the south of the new runway. However, there were all some impacts as well in Richfield along the border of Cedar Avenue with redevelopment needs and some noise from sideline activity that was concerning. But the represents actually significant impact.
Further questions of members? If not, thank you very much. Further comments?
Wrap up with one comment?
Sure. Mr. Hamill.
You were very gracious in giving a great deal of your time to us about a week or week and a half ago on an airport tour. Many members of the committee were not able to participate because of schedule conflicts and so forth. Let me just tell you that we are having another airport tour, and we would invite members of this committee who are unable to go on this committee's specific tour to ride along with the Transportation Committee on Friday morning. The bus will be picking you up in front of the state office building at 8:45. We'll be returning to the airport promptly at 11:30. So if you've got Friday morning available in your schedule, you'd receive, I think, a very thorough briefing of the airport and a complete drive around on the runway system and through the facilities to kind of get a handle on what we have as an asset at the Metropolitan Airports Commission. So you're all invited to join the Transition Committee as well and come along with us on their tour.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. Thank you. Members, just one thing, if we could quickly approve the minutes before we leave for today. I would entertain a motion to approve February 5th, February 7th, and February 12th. Mr. Shumper, Representative Shumper, moves the minutes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. This meeting is adjourned.